In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
And welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Laura Laker, it says here.
Brilliant.
I'm Ned Bolting.
And
I'm Adam Tranter. I'm the only person who is actually the person that they are.
Should have said I'm Adam Tranter.
You're the only authentic voice here. Laura, I kind of know this because I've just had a coffee with you ahead of the recording, but what you've been up to? Book stuff?
Yeah, I learned to ride no hands.
Oh yes, you did. That's a big achievement.
Yeah. Just happened one day. I was just riding along and I'm busy brain and I just sat up and then it happened like magic. It's like the hand of ET.
And it's not hard actually, is it?
No, it's not very hard.
It's quite hard on a Brompton.
Is it?
Yeah, very hard on a Brompton, a little wheel. But that's such a shame that Look Mum No Hands, cafe, has now closed down because otherwise you could have swanned in there and sort of like taken ownership of it.
Finally got myself one of their little caps.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wearing one of their jumpers.
Is that?
It's a Look Mum No Hands jumper.
Did you pay for it?
I did. I got a little discount. I went to Bristol for family fun and I found myself taking photos of cycle lanes and stuff like
Standard.
That. Really interesting, actually, and really problematic. Bristol has quite high levels of cycling, which is, you know, is obviously a good thing.
Yeah.
They've obviously gone through the stage of like doing the whole cycling infrastructure thing because they've built loads of it. But the really challenging thing is that they've built it in a way that it looks like pavement. Yeah. So they built it as part of the public realm. So it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
But it's sort of too clever.
Yeah.
So most people don't realise it's a cycle lane.
So basically you've developed a lot of all this kind of conflict.
Yeah, yeah. Basically people, you know, I know what cycle lanes look like and I found myself going, oh, I'm in a cycle lane.
Yeah.
So it was quite interesting, but obviously massive high levels of cycling. It's kind of seen it as a cycling city.
Yeah.
But it's had this kind of, no, it's not a cycling city because of the infrastructure.
In spite of it.
It's really weird that, you know, 30 years ago when I lived in Germany, in Hamburg, when I was a young man, there's a lot of cycling infrastructure where they rely on shared pavements, like we do here lots, don't we? So there's a lot of bike lanes that look a bit like pavements and are kind of our pavements. And I remember I certainly wasn't a cyclist back then and it never even crossed my mind to get on a bike. So I was pure pedestrian and I used to get infuriated by Germans sort of like, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling to get rid, you know, to get pedestrians out of the way. In fact, it kind of like maddened me. But now I was in exactly the same city recently and kind of like looked at it from the other side. Yeah, because I was on a...
I think it's funny. Japan that they culturally allow cycling on the pavement and it's just totally culturally accepted.
Yeah.
There's no conflict. Like, maybe there is some conflict, but it's just sort of seen as a totally normal thing to do.
Mm.
Just culturally. Just after you. No, after you. No. It's just very polite.
Anyone going to ask what I've been up to?
What have you been up to, Ned?
Okay, good. Thanks. Not much, really, to be honest. Except yesterday I went on a walk up Deptford Creek in the mud.
I saw that.
Honestly, if you live in London and can get there, it's one of the best things. I mean, it's amazing. I've lived here 25 years and walked past the creek or cycled past the creek for all that time and didn't realise you could just pull on a pair of waders and walk up it at low tide. It's amazing.
Are you supervised? Is there risk
of
quicksand?
Yeah. There's a guy called Nick who's been working conservation there in the creek for decades, and he's got a real interesting take on. He said at one point in the 1990s, they decided to clear it up, and they took out 400 shopping trolleys from the creek.
Oh my god!
And then they did a bit of evidence. They kind of looked at what happened to the young fish stock there, and when the shopping trolleys have been taken out, the fish stock dropped by half because the young fish use the shopping trolleys to hide. So it's become part of, so they now leave the shopping trolleys in.
No way.
And nature kind of takes them over, which is kind of beautiful. Mm. But he explained all that while we were standing next to a lime bike that was inverted kind of vertically into the mud. And he, at the end of it, he said, we'll probably take the lime bike out.
Yeah. The battery,
get the battery and all that. Anyway, that's what we've been up to. Let's introduce our guest. This time we have with us Polly Herbert. Hello, Polly.
Hi.
A solicitor who represents the loved ones of those killed and seriously injured in road traffic collisions. Polly's very kindly come all the way down from Manchester to our London studio, as I'd like to refer to it, to join us today. Now, Polly represented the family of Frankie Jules Huff, a pregnant mother of two, who was killed by a speeding driver who was filming himself driving in excess of 100 miles an hour in May. That's shocking. I suppose that's our starting point, though, Polly. Can you put the sort of detail in around this kind of quite extraordinary case?
Yes. Frankie had her two children with her in the car, was pregnant with her third, and also had her nephew in the car. It was just a family day. It was a Saturday, and she was going to her eldest football match. So very short journey, about 15 minutes, had said goodbye to some loved ones, was meeting other family there on the sports pitch. Just had a flat tyre, pulled over, as you would expect, on the motorway, and hadn't even got to the point of asking for any help when the defendant, who'd been driving his vehicle for some considerable time along the M66 and also supporting roads, ploughed into her vehicle at approximately 92 miles per hour. Now, before the collision actually happened, there was quite a lot of dash cam footage taken by other members of the public, but more frighteningly, taken by the defendant himself on a handheld mobile phone. So he'd been driving, weaving in and out of traffic, undertaking, overtaking, using slip roads to undertake two lanes of traffic, tailgating cars. We had dash cam footage from people, but also lots of witness statements saying how aggressive and scary his driving was. Some people had submitted this to the police, but also had said it was an accident waiting to happen. And one of the things that I would like any of your listeners from this podcast to take away is that reference, that word accident. It's very, very emotive. As Calvin, the partner of Frankie, would say, if we could avoid using that, it wasn't an accident waiting to happen. It was completely avoidable. But he was maintaining this, going up to speeds of 123 miles an hour on more than one occasion before he lost control, ultimately, hit the crash barrier and then crashed into Frankie's vehicle.
Crikey. And the defendant's name was Adil Iqbal.
Yes.
What happened to him?
Well, the long and short of it is he's got a custodial sentence now. He had a custodial sentence at the first hearing, but unfortunately the family had to appeal that as it was considered to be unduly lenient. But behind that, you could look at this and examine what years he actually had. But for Calvin and the rest of the family, this isn't about years. It's not about measuring punishment in years. It's about sending a very important signal out to people who drive like this. There is, it's not even an underbelly. It's there on social media. It's on TikTok. It's on Facebook, Snapchat. You can see there are these people who routinely drive like this to get kicks, to get likes. And so what Calvin and the family were hoping for was that effectively the full force of the law was used. And if there is a life sentence there, in circumstances such as this, where they've taken such a prolonged, aggressive manner in their driving that's dangerous and reckless, that should really see the full force of a life sentence.
because there's a degree of kind of intent, I suppose. This isn't a moment of, yeah. This isn't a little flash in the pan moment. There's no red mist.
That's where that word accident comes in, right? Is because all these things are decisions. They're outcomes of the decisions that have been made. An accident is something, just one of those things. And this individual had the opportunity to not do those things several times for a long period of time.
Yeah.
So it's willful, but without getting so early on into the technicals of it, the law has a kind of strange approach to careless driving, dangerous driving. What we would count as, you know, this wasn't careless driving, but there are some offences that, you know, look like they're dangerous, but in the law they are careless, for example. And for me, a careless thing is, you know, a lapse of
concentration,
not having 5 pints and running someone over. You can't carelessly have 5 pints, but in the law you can. So I'm sure we're going to get into technicalities of it, but a lot of people, and certainly for me, you know, I see these cases online, a lot of us do, and we're just kind of, even myself with, you know, having some degree of authority, being able to do something locally, feel almost powerless. And the thing that frightens me in my region is that I don't know when the next collision will be. So therefore, it's totally out of control. There's no element of control in it. But I think what gets a lot of people, I see in the comments of the case online, is that the reality of what sentencing is provided and what people expect to be provided is deeply out of proportion. And I wonder what you think to overall how society treats road crime and road violence versus other forms of violence that is done with a similar level of intent in this case.
We should probably just say, because I'm not sure that Polly actually made it explicit, that he was sentenced to 12 years initially.
Initially.
And then on appeal that was
increased to 15.
Yeah. And what was the driving ban in this case?
The driving ban has been increased now, so I think it's 15 years in total, which will run concurrent to to the sentence, yeah.
Mm. So he'll get out of prison and he'll be able to get back behind a wheel straight
away. At some point, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the question a lot of people had for this case is, and I think the judge in fact said this, is that this is one of the worst cases of causing death by dangerous driving has ever been seen, possibly in history. And the maximum sentence now is life imprisonment for death by dangerous driving. That was thanks to campaigning done by Theresa May.
Yes.
And if this does not warrant a life sentence, what would you have to do to get one? I think that links into that question, isn't it, about how we perceive road violence compared to other forms.
Yeah, and I think it's what's socially acceptable and what's really important. There's various strands to that, really. In terms of how we view road crime, I suppose the way that Calvin, Frankie's partner, would suggest, it's almost like a scenario with gateway drugs. And if you look at a teenager experimenting with cannabis or, gosh, helium balloons as it is now, or whatever the local, it's that gateway of going in to do more and more offences. You could potentially take that lens and use it for road crime. So it may start out with somebody just showing off in front of their mates, and instead of doing 30, they're doing 35. And instead of stopping on amber, they're actually going through red. And it's those little things of pushing more boundaries, that instead of being sat next to someone in the car when they're doing it, why aren't we calling them out? Because it's impacting us. It's a risk to our safety as much as it is to theirs and other road users. So I think there's an element of how do we ensure that future generations make it socially unacceptable, like they have done with drink driving. If we think of the campaigns that they had in the 80s, Mungo Jerry, you know, was on the radio, and it was, what was it, summertime or something that was used for that ad campaign, but it resonated with people of my generation. Mm. My dad would go out on a Sunday lunch and would have 2 pints and then drive. Mm. And I would call him out, and I'd feel confident calling him out about that. Mm. My dad doesn't do that anymore. Mm. Many people don't do that anymore because it's socially unacceptable to do that, but it's taken generational change. So I think we need the generational change. We need to be advocating for younger people, educating younger people, which is something Calvin's really passionate about. Then we have to have a look at, why is it acceptable? Why are we accepting road crime and violence at this level? When you look at the numbers, 5 per day, you know, there's a police officer that's knocking on 5 people's front doors to tell them that their loved one has been killed. Why, society, do we think that's acceptable?
the top of the five killed every day on the roads is 60 serious injuries,
yes,
which is people with life-changing injuries.
60?
Yeah, yeah, every day.
I think it's one every 17 seconds or something ridiculous that they've equated it to, in terms of the... Well, that can't be right.
Total
actually.
Injuries, potentially.
Total, injury, yeah. Total injuries,
slight injuries,
yeah.
As well.
Yeah, slight injuries as well.
And they're often not reported,
no,
to police, so they don't make the stats.
No, but I, yeah, think, you know, increasingly as a car driver, and I love my car, I'm not a cyclist because I got knocked off a bike when I was 7 and I still haven't got the psychological ability to go back onto,
like,
a bike.
It's fair enough, it's like being bitten by a dog.
Yes, yeah, but I do at centre parks, but that's my limit. Yeah. And I love walking everywhere, absolutely love walking everywhere, but overwhelmingly we all these different road users, bike, pedestrian, car, that just seems to think that we are more important than the other person. I think that's what it boils down to. We're always in a rush and we have the right of way, no matter if we actually do in reality. So we're tapping into so much, I think, that we actually need to change, there not is, just attitude to road crime.
Yeah, there is a real cultural problem. And I hear people who come over from Europe, maybe for the first time to the UK, and they're quite shocked, actually, at the standard of driving sometimes, and feel like they're about to get run down at any moment. They're sort of crossing side streets, people just drive at you and,
yeah,
honk at you, and it's really quite, it's kind of astonishing when you step back and think, in any other field of life we wouldn't behave in this way, but for some reason when we're on the,
yeah,
roads.
Yeah,
I was quite taken with how you outlined that though, Polly, because you didn't just say this is something that drivers do, this is something that we all do,
no,
as we get
do,
you know. And I think that going back to my experiences of living abroad and traveling a lot abroad, I think we're also probably quite an aggressive nation of jaywalkers, for better or worse.
Oh, hold up. You've reached a controversial klaxon.
Controversial klaxon. Are we not?
Jaywalking is an invented construct.
All right,
invented,
but you know what I mean. What should I
industry.
Say? I forgot about that. You're perhaps right. Go on, remind
just
us why.
To make sure. Well, yeah. I don't know. People that feel like we can cross the road when we would like to cross
the
road.
All right, we have quite a lawless attitude to that. Or
There is no law against crossing the road. In fact, they might even have right of way, depending on how they do it.
Yeah, but I want to go back to my experience of living in Germany, where if you dared to cross at a pedestrian crossing where there were no cars coming on a red light, you know, for the pedestrians, you would get loudly tutted at by everybody else who was where. Oh yeah, it was really frowned upon. In fact, you get harangued. What sort of message does that send out to the kids? And I'd kind of go, don't care, gonna cross the road anyway. So I think we're all quite just interested in our own agenda,
yes,
at getting from A to B. And that's
Get away from the jaywalking controversy. Yeah, potentially.
And I'm sure when I'm on a bike, I have certain behaviours that probably would fit into that as well.
There's a different...
Except the difference is 2 tons of metal.
Well, yeah, there's a difference in a couple of respects, isn't there? Because one is, you know, when enforcement is limited as well, and a lot of this comes down to police enforcement and how police handle this, they have to enforce those that pose the most danger statistically. That's just what you do when you have limited resource. It was actually Westminster Police that have, you know, said in the past that, you know, all road users probably offend at the same rate, but proportionately, obviously, the damage that they can cause is different. And therefore, when you have limited resources, you focus on the ones that are most likely to cause real harm. And then there's another thing that you said about kind of like, we all do it. And I wanted, just being honest, I wanted to sort of chip in and say, this is different though. But then I remembered something I've also said, so I'm contradicting myself, like when I think about it, is actually there are a lot of people who die in road collisions and are seriously injured, who are killed or seriously injured by, dare I say, inverted commas, law-abiding motorists. And they're not obviously law-abiding, but, like, you know, to coin the phrase that maybe a newspaper would use, they're normal people who might check their phone, or they might do, you know, they might speed or whatever. And when I had all these problems that I wanted to tackle in the West Midlands, you know, when families were coming and saying, look, they've got to do something here, I instinctively wanted to go, well, we should come down on a ton of bricks on the people that are, you know, racing on TikTok and the people who are taking drugs and driving. And we should. But it's right to challenge everybody, because we all have a part to play in this, and actually the results can be as difficult and as dangerous. You know, people die from lapses of concentration and checking a phone and a bit of speeding. It's not all the extreme things that you saw in the case that you worked on.
And I think that's what's really hard. There's a lot of public interest and there's a lot of outrage in relation to this particular case because so many people go, well, clearly, I would never make that choice. I wouldn't do what he did. I wouldn't be doing those manoeuvres on the motorway. So why would you equate this to what I would possibly do, just creeping over 30 or just creeping over 40? It's that whole thing of, guys, we're all there to share the road. And I love my car. I love doing track days. I love driving fast on track days. Frankie's father was on a track day when this actually happened. So there are times and places to get your kicks. And it's not pushing the boundaries on a road where there are pedestrians, cyclists and other road users. It's just we've got to get to that point where we see travel as a route to A to B in the safest possible way. And unfortunately, there are so many cars on the road, you know, we just have to change our mindset.
Yeah. And there's the societal, I guess, mindset shift on a societal level. But then there's also how we treat and punish people who do these things, whether it's creeping above 30 miles an hour in 30 zone or whether it's driving as this defendant did. And I wonder how what you see in the you're a civil solicitor, you see, and what you see and how you see these cases being dealt with and how, I don't know, frustrating or otherwise you find this.
Really frustrating because aside from the criminal side of things, there's the civil court as well for the families that I help.
So and that's sort of the litigation side, the insurance claims, the money that a family would get for their bereavement, that may be
there
a clumsy
is,
way of describing it.
Yeah, there is there's no compensation for the death of a loved one. It's completely impossible to put any kind of price on that. And what the civil courts look at is the financial consequences of somebody's death. But to give you an example, I'm routinely in people's front rooms who have been asked for some civil support and some guidance, and they're not really given necessarily the support for the criminal side of things as well. So I'm sat there having to explain to them how they actually won't get justice through the criminal courts. And I will.
This is what you tell people.
Very, very early on, because you've got to manage people's expectations. They're in crisis and they're vulnerable. And obviously, you have to gauge the people that are in front of you at the time. But I think you need to be realistic with families and not give them that false hope that they're going to get an outcome that they think is equivalent to justice through the criminal court. And I also say that for the civil side as well. And in Frankie's case, Calvin, her partner, they'd been together for nearly 2 years and she was pregnant with their baby. They'd had the gender reveal ceremony. They were talking about houses, looking at properties that they could blend their family and move in together. The civil court does not recognise him as a parent. It doesn't recognise him as a partner. And there is legislation still now which refers to illegitimate children.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is so much stacked against families in navigating an antiquated system, let alone are their voices heard? Are they properly supported? I can honestly say no. Having dealt with this kind of road traffic collision for the last 20 years, the support that families are now receiving is woeful compared to what they received 20 years ago.
And is this isn't presumably, well, it's, I know it's not just the case for victims of road traffic collisions. This is across the criminal justice system. I think it sounds like just layered on top of that is the fact that people aren't getting justice in any way with road collisions because of these problems.
Yeah, but it's also when you look at the sentencing, but if you also look at just the way that information is communicated or the way that they're handled at court. You know, I've gone to cases where it was particularly difficult in COVID times when there was a lot of restrictions and a lot of burden on the courts, but I would turn up with families and there would be no witness support there or no victim support there. They've been in the same corridor as the defendant's family, waiting to go in with no separation whatsoever. And you're walking around court saying, can I just please have a room where I can take these people? Now, I'm a civil solicitor. I'm not even really meant to be there. I'm not a criminal solicitor. I'm not CPS.
Why are you there?
Because I support my families no matter what. I think they need someone in their corner. And if that has to be me, then that's what I will do. I've gone to coroner's courts where there is nobody there, not one person there. And the family are sat in an empty coroner's court on their own. No usher, nobody, until the coroner then comes in. So these families, you know, on no matter how you look at it, they are not given the adequate support, let alone the sentencing at the end of it.
Wow. And some of this will be familiar to anyone who's read The Secret Barrister, which is very revealing about the criminal justice system and how badly that is funded and how badly that fails people. And the barristers are very poorly paid themselves. And, and it's just people are exodusing out of that field professionally. Yeah. And I presume it's the same. You see this as well.
Yeah, and I think the government has recently brought in legislation as well to cut the costs of civil fees as well, civil legal fees. So potentially families would be expected to navigate this on their own. But we're committing, my firm's committing to doing a lot of pro bono work to help those families through. But yeah, it's speaking with the Attorney General's office and the barrister in this particular case at the Court of Appeal. He didn't have anything positive really to say. He was exceptional at talking to Calvin and gave him a lot of time explaining why the sentencing wasn't where it should be and why the life sentence hasn't been provided. But effectively, it was hands up, the system's broken.
I can appreciate that this would be sort of secondhand information, but you're obviously much closer to this case and generally the victims than we are.
Yeah.
What was the reasoning between not getting a life sentence, and how can that? Yeah, I can't get my head around it. I don't think anyone can. So I'm interested to know how it was communicated.
No, and they have three different grading structures, A, B, and C, basically, a simple way of putting it. And A is the worst grading structure you can get, so you should attract the maximum sentence at that point. But the way the guidelines are drafted is it's been increased to 8 to 18 years for the maximum sentence. So he started off at the 18 years and then added on, and he could have potentially added on more for aggravating features. But according to the Attorney General's office and the barrister on the day, it was very much due to the fact that he hadn't done this before. And it was explicitly spoken to the family that really the only scenario they could see a life sentence actually being handed down is if someone had already killed somebody in a collision, served some prison time, come back out again, and then killed somebody again.
That's a pretty high bar.
Yes, it is. I think it's really disappointing, though, to a lot of victims and road safety charities who have campaigned to get a life sentence to dangerous driving, to actually now have that realisation of, I thought we won this a couple of years ago. The legislation here removed intent. Yeah. It removed intent.
So to the best of your knowledge, has a life sentence been handed down?
No.
Not once?
No.
How long has this been on the statute books then?
It was passed in 22, but enforcement came in July 23. Okay, so very
it's
early.
It's all right, it's very new.
And that's why there was a lot of media attention in this particular case, because I think there was a hope that this would be the first life sentence that was passed down.
Yeah.
And there's a massive amount of disappointment, like you were saying before, Adam, that actually all three judges in the Court of Appeal concurred that this is the worst case they have ever seen. Yet still that life sentence doesn't happen.
Mm. And would it be fair to say that this is the longest sentence for death by dangerous driving currently there?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you look at the, you know, the headlines of so many years, what you've got to remember as well is that it starts off at a certain level and then there's mitigating features. Mm. And I think that's what families also find very difficult is the mitigating features. This gentleman, he worked in his father's gym, and there was a group of disadvantaged children that were brought to the gym one day, and he helped them out with the equipment. And there was a letter from that person who has organised that trip to say that he was of good character, and that's taken into account.
I read one the other day, a case where the person had killed somebody, but it was stated in mitigation that he had a dog, and that was seen as sort of valid to put forward as a reason why that person's sentence might not, you know, might need to be reduced or might need to be taken into consideration. I think that probably just taps into how we see this is a kind of, you know, driving almost as a right and you know, not treating it as
real. I don't understand the dog thing. So that, because this person had a dog,
he would have to look after the dog. So could the judge take into consideration that he did some charity work? I'm being a little bit flippant, but also not flippant, because it's a dog. The guy did some charity work and he owned a dog. And at the, you know, the sentencing, his barrister put forward the case that, could you go easy on him because he's got a dog to look after? And this is when someone has been killed in front, probably said in front of the family watching there. Well,
wow.
Talk, it is.
Yeah.
We had a good one last week. I say a good one. This is awful the way to describe it, but a pedestrian was killed by a driver 6:30 in the morning. She was driving at speeds up to 76 miles per hour and a 30 when she killed him. And the defendant counsel for her suggested that because it was during COVID and it was quite quiet on the roads, that really it wasn't as bad. It shouldn't really be seen as excessive speed because it was, you know, it was COVID and it was quiet on the road. And it, you know, it's just incredulous that I know that he's there to do his job. This isn't a judgment on the barrister at all, but the fact that he even stood up and thought there might be sway of a judge.
You have to do that with a straight face.
Yeah.
Societally, there is the groundwork in place as a society to be able to make those arguments and for people to nod along.
Yeah, the levels of speeding we saw during COVID kind of align with that, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, there were some quite
This is all really bleak, I have to say. It's kind of darkly funny, but also absolutely awful.
Yeah.
Is there evidence to suggest that if these sentencing guidelines were properly enforced, as let's hope they will be in the future, that will act as a deterrent? Or are we trying to appeal to a group of people in society for whom there is no deterrent, doesn't really kind of like hit the sides?
I think we have to take as many lines of attack as we possibly can. Mm. And for Calvin, he and Road Peace, I work very closely with that charity.
Yeah.
It's about educating younger people to make it socially unacceptable. It's about talking to social media companies to say, what on earth are you doing putting these videos on there? They should be taken down and reporting
them.
Right. It's about advising people. I've got a dash cam in my car. I've never had a dash cam in my car, but after seeing what evidence was used in that case, I've now got a dash cam. I know where I can send that to with local police forces. We can all do that. If you've got the financial means, do it. Put it in your car. I certainly feel safer. In terms of deterring these people, there's been many years of many campaigns from victims who have all told incredibly sad stories. And this is still happening and it's still getting worse. So what Calvin would like to do is actually change that message. If you're not going to think about Frankie, if you're not going to think about my unborn daughter or the three kids that were in the vehicle, then at least think about what you're potentially risking. You're potentially risking going to prison on a life sentence. Mm. And that's the last bit of the battle, I think, that needs to actually change. And unfortunately, when this legislation was put forward and was seen as a win for victims of road crime, this has been lost in translation because we're being told that actually it's not going to get handed down. So I think that needs to be looked at, and that's where the gap is now.
In terms of the deterrence, one of the things I'm finding very hard to get my head around is the driving bans, basically. You know, you can get a driving ban handed down alongside a sentence. Typically, you might serve a sentence if you go to jail, and if you don't, then, you know, there are many cases, without being specific, you know, where someone has killed another road user, a vulnerable road user, and ended up with, you know, like a 2 or 3 year driving ban. And the thing that I learned recently was that those driving bans don't get more serious with reoffending. So if you commit greater crimes, you can get a greater driving ban, but you can't just for the sake of it's the fourth time you've been banned, sir. You still get like a ban a year at a time or 2 years at a time. And that person is clearly not following, you know, if anyone else showed that much content to the punishments they've been given in any other form of law, it would get more serious.
Be a custodial sentence.
With driving, it's kind of like it's almost a joke that they're going to do it again and it never gets any more serious. But then another part of my brain goes, well, if you give them a lifetime ban, they're not going to follow it because they've shown several times that they don't follow the ban. But I'm interested to get your thought on the other parts of, obviously, it's not just about the sentence and sometimes about rehabilitation. Sometimes it's about what they can and can't do. And also societally, that driving is seen as a right, not a privilege. And therefore, you can't take someone's right to drive away, even if they have killed a mother. You know, that person will be able to drive again in 15 years' time. I just can't get my head around that. I'm hoping for someone who works it, you'll be able to tell me that, you know, maybe it will be better, maybe it will change, no. Maybe there's a reason.
No, I don't think so. And I think, you know, when you tap into quite a lot of this discussion online, you unfortunately fall into the camps of, well, you either hate motorists or you're on the motorist side. Well, actually, we can all come together and have some common ground here. If you cannot drive a vehicle safely, why on earth should you just be able to then get your license back? Why isn't it subject to further testing or further restrictions, for example? And I think one of the matters actually that Frankie's dad brought up, and it kind of links into the licensing point, is in this particular case, the judge kept on coming back to the fact that the defendant was so young, he didn't fully appreciate the consequences of what he was doing. Now, there's no graded licenses at the moment, which says, well, if you're between the ages of 17 and 25, you're only allowed to go out between these hours, or you're only allowed a vehicle with this kind of capacity. So could we possibly investigate that? So if it's so hard for politicians to get their heads around, or the general public to get their heads around disqualification, why can't we look at different retesting or different courses to take or different graded licenses, which I'm not saying that people should get their license back like that, but we've got to be realistic in terms of where could we potentially take this campaigning, and a happy medium for the moment could be, well, okay, graded licenses then.
This is something that Detective Superintendent Andy Cox has been calling for some time, as well as an end to exceptional hardship claims.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, because young men are disproportionately responsible for serious collisions.
Yeah.
Under 25.
Yeah.
We're just so soft on this. I have to catch myself, because sometimes I feel like I'm, you know, like capital punishment or whatever. And you go, well, about half the population when polled say that we should have the death penalty.
Well, there is that.
So what I was saying.
We know that referendums are wonderful things.
No, not quite. Yeah. But what I was saying, I guess, is I don't want to be that person that's saying, oh, yes, we should do this. And because it's an easy thing to say, you've got to kind of look at it. But
it's the ban that's important.
We're so soft on it. And we give people so many second chances as well, not through the driving ban, but in the case that you worked on, I have to do a bit of jargon busting, but the defendant had something called a Section 59 notice, which is basically when a police officer witnesses someone driving dangerously, they can issue a Section 59 notice, which is a kind of a bit of an ASBO warning kind of thing. And if they are caught again, they can have their vehicle seized. And in the West Midlands, where we've got a High Court injunction, they can be sent to court for breaching the High Court injunction. So part of me thinks it's quite a good thing, because it gives the police more powers to tackle this. But then the other part of me thinks, well, they've already shown that they're not capable of driving sensibly once, and we give them a kind of letter that gives them a second chance. And in this case, that person got a second chance. You know, they were driving dangerously. A police officer saw that person driving dangerously in another totally separate incident. And if we'd taken it seriously then, perhaps the second incident wouldn't have been able to occur.
I think you have to have a look at the type of person that would drive in this manner. It's not going to be isolated, in terms of they're not going to be the type of person that just goes out one day and goes, I'm going to drive at 123 miles an hour.
Sure.
They're going to probably be quite naughty in other areas and build up to it. And so, like you say, it is that difficulty of going, well, do you throw the book at them then? And is it actually going to prevent something, or are they going to circumnavigate around it anyway? And I was with a family a couple of years ago who their daughter was killed walking to school, and the defendant was driving without insurance, without a license, without MOT, brakes didn't work properly on his vehicle, and he collided with her as she was crossing the road. He left her and drove immediately to a car mechanic's garage and tried to get his windscreen repaired. When they said no and turned him away, he went to another garage and said, oh, some teenagers had just been throwing bricks at my windscreen. And we went through all of this, no remorse whatsoever shown by this defendant. Had the custodial sentence, had the driving ban. And the family said, it just feels hollow. He's whatever happens, he's going to go out of prison and he'll do it again.
What was he sentenced to, Polly?
14 years.
Concurrent driving ban.
Yeah.
Back in the road in 14 years.
And it's very difficult, because it might make a difference to us sat around this table and a lot of your listeners, because we go, oh my God, we've done something terrible inadvertently. Oh my God, we'd never ever do that again.
It's not penetrating his world.
No, exactly.
that's where the social media stuff is really, really challenging.
I was going to raise a thing. I'm sitting here for 4 or 5 minutes wondering if I should even raise, because it's kind of like such a complicated can of worms. And it impinges on all sorts of really quite toxic arguments and difficult debates. But is there a tech solution to legitimate driving somewhere down the line in the future?
I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah, because it plays into Ulez conspiracy theories, you know, but facial recognition at every street corner. Who's that driving there? Can we scan their face as they drive past? Are they, you know, I mean, if I go and hire a car, which is the only time I do drive because I don't own a car, I literally have to hand over my driving license. They check my face to see whether my face matches. So this kind of exists, doesn't it? Anyway.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to say it. Because you've said it.
Yeah. You know why I hesitated, yeah, right?
So when people, again, not an expert in this area, but obviously electronic tagging is a thing, right? It is electronic. When people leave prison on license, they get electronic tags. Yes. There's obviously the probation service would tell you that also they can't keep tabs and the police can't keep tabs on everybody anyway.
Yeah.
But the technology would be there that if you have a driving ban and you've committed an offence and you've maybe been released from prison on licence, but you're still banned, then a electronic tag could inform the police, for example, if you are travelling above 25 miles an hour, for example.
As your iPhone does when it says, are you driving?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now that raises all sorts of, you know, sort of questions, but people have shown that they can't adhere to driving bans, and it's not like we're stopping people who are playing by the rules. It's really people have only shown that they cannot play by those rules. And again, so I keep coming back to that tech solution as well in my head.
Yeah.
Such a challenging one, isn't it?
It is.
And there is also the kind of...
I don't like the idea. Sorry. No, I think that the tagging seems like potentially quite an interesting avenue to explore. I don't like the facial recognition thing, I must admit. Instinctively.
And it involves you retrofitting cars and stuff like that, which is just totally impossible. Whereas you put the onus on the individual potentially.
That's interesting. What do you feel about that, Polly or Laura? I mean,
electronic tagging does exist already, and I guess you get a curfew. So I don't know if it's that different.
But I think whatever you do, that there will be a workaround. The criminal fraternity are a criminal fraternity for a reason, and they will. I mean, that's not to say don't hold out hope, but I think, you know, when you're looking at enforcement, you've kind of lost the battle. The battle very much for me is prevention, and that prevention has to be through education of younger people.
Yeah.
And, you know, going back to what Calvin wants to do, it's road safety education within schools, but actually he's starting from the very basics of respect. Just the very basics. He wants to go in and teach people respect on our roads. That'd be road user, be a walker, a cyclist, or a car user. You know, it's all about that preventative, because by the time you're thinking about tagging people, you've lost. Society's lost if that's what we're doing.
Yeah, and there is already a kind of civil lever, as well, an insurance lever in the form of black boxes. And I know that young men particularly, whose insurance is very high, insurance premiums are very high, if they get a black box fitted, then the insurer will insure them for less. And that can be quite motivating. And I have heard of youngsters who've unplugged the black box, been contacted by the insurer, and then gone elsewhere. You know, they don't want to adhere to it because they're basically having to drive a certain way, but it does seem to be effective.
Yeah.
Mm.
The education things, again, very hard to get under the skin of, right? Because there is form for this in terms of, as you say, with drunk driving and all the things. You know, people have changed societal, but there are also people that still do it, and it causes dramatic consequences, and there's still... I think around 150, you know, fatal collisions each year that result of drink driving. So it's kind of, you know, in response to there will always be a workaround. There will always be people that do it, but that's not to say it's not, you know, it's obviously not worth considering, because we don't do it very well, do we? We tend to go into schools and tell kids not to get run over by adults, and we don't actually spend much time at all trying to educate.
No, I mean, it is quite scary. My two... and 9 and 11, and before they could even walk across the road, if I was taking them out in a pram, I would stop and you talk to them and go like, look left and right and look for cars, you know, and listen for car. And I am the most relaxed parent, apart from when it comes to road safety, and they know that that's drilled into them. But I was staggered that other parents don't naturally teach that. And my daughter would have play dates, and we lived in a very, very small village at the time where there were very few cars. And the kids would come over and play and just run across the road. And it's just like, as parents as well, we have a responsibility. We can't abdicate it and say schools have to pick it up. They did used to pick it up, but they don't anymore. They just don't. So we all also need to talk about it to our children or our grandchildren. Mm. My grandmother and my mum are terrible crossing roads and jaywalking. Absolutely terrible. And I went off at my mum once because we were walking across and she took my daughter across on what was a red man, but it was a green for the cars with no vehicles around. Mm. But
I were that German parent.
I am that
you?
German parent. Stop. No, absolutely yeah. Not.
I'm rarely,
somewhere between German and British.
Well, I see, in my job, I work on the other side of things where I know there are traffic engineers there who want your family to wait for 80 seconds, knowing full well there's no vehicles coming, till they give you a green man, because it makes the charts look good and it gives you traffic flow. So I hate the system, ultimately. Yeah. So, we should wait for a green man.
Yeah.
But also if people that, you know, have rigged the system to make, you know, crossing the road so unattractive, you know, I've had conversations where people are like, we shouldn't put a crossing in there, because people might cross the road and it will slow down traffic, or it will cost too much to maintain, or anything like that. And while we're still having the conversations, I think it's quite hard to get annoyed with people when they want to cross the road in the desire line. We should facilitate that.
Nuanced. I mean, we're a bit off topic here, aren't we? But there is that slightly more nuanced thing about that I always used to justify my position vis-a-vis pedestrian red lights and green lights, of like, especially in terms of educating kids and bringing them up in the right way, actually use your ears and your eyes, so don't just trust the light.
Yeah.
Because if you blindly trust that green light, you've no idea what the motorist approaching that crossing is actually their intent is. So, you know, you've got to be both. I mean, you've got to kind of like trust the system to a certain extent, but also bring in your own.
Yes.
Your own judgment.
Yeah.
And if your own judgment at that point says, there is no car for half a mile in either direction, I might just nip across the road. I think that's a legitimate approach as well.
Yeah.
Because the system is rigged, you're right. Can I just go back and ask you a question here, Adam? And Polly, I think you probably have this information at your fingertips as well. But going back to disqualified drivers and terrible incidents, crimes, road crimes, we have a problem in this country, don't we, of the percentage of cars which are being driven at any given time by disqualified drivers is very high. I don't know what it is. Don't know whether either of you know or what the best guess is.
Not at the same time, but in Britain, there's claimed to be around 1.2 million uninsured drivers in the country. And a fun fact, in the postcodes of uninsured drivers, Birmingham has 7 of the top 10 postcodes in the country.
Well done, Birmingham. That's not great, is it?
No.
And then my sort of follow-up question to that was, Polly, maybe you know this, in terms of road crime, are disqualified drivers overrepresented, or can you not say that?
No, I mean, certainly not in the cases that I see. No. Most of them do have licences that I see. What we are seeing more of are uninsured drivers, probably due to the cost of living crisis more than anything else. And interestingly, going back to your point before about disqualification and making it hard hitting, when this legislation was put in to increase life sentences for dangerous driving, I spoke to quite a few police officers who were actually worried that hit and runs would increase as a result, because people might be afraid of the fact that they could be looking at a life sentence. And certainly we've seen that increase. We've seen pedestrians on the pavements being run over increasing. You know, it's actually quite scary. In terms, but disqualified drivers or online drivers, seeing that particularly, which probably is because that's one of the easiest things to do. Mm. It probably is that the licensing is so easy in terms of what's prohibitive is the cost of insurance.
Yeah.
I think there is some stat, and I don't have it to hand, but that Andy Cox, who we mentioned, gave me, and it was something he did in London where basically looked at the people who got caught for disqualified driving, and those that got caught for it had been caught several times, and they were much more likely to be involved in other aspects of criminality as well. I don't have the data to hand, but it was a marker for other
stuff. You
know, even not wearing a seatbelt, he's found in his work, and speeding slightly, Because if you're going to be involved in criminal activity, the chances are you're going to do it in every walk of life.
We come to the end, and we've got one of those episodes where we're just like, God, this is so bad.
Yeah, this is.
Yeah.
What can change? What can we do? We bear in mind, you know, with pragmatists, things take a long time to change. But what are the things? Because I noticed that Road Peace have been asking for, you know, their Remain and Report campaign.
Yeah.
You know, that seems like there are subtle things around Remain and Report. It aims to have a new law against actually leaving the scene of a collision and reducing that as a factor, aggregating factor.
And it isn't already. Because hit and run isn't...
I mean, in terms of when you have a look at that grading, it would be considered to be an aggravating factor. And there is like an offence for failure to stop. Mm-hmm. But it's having a look at increasing that, because I think that's the backlash of the dangerous driving, hit and run, and it's trying to negate that. Right.
And it's come back to me now, the limit is 48 hours as well. So you could kill somebody, leave the scene, 24 hours, pop into a police station, and not be seen to be leaving the scene of a collision or an accident, as the law says, but I refuse to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what can you do? was your question. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's keeping up the dialogue, because it was great to see so many people commenting on the M66 collision and really thinking, my gosh, this is awful in terms of the lack of sentencing. But it's also just being minded that we all have a part to play in terms of making sure people are as safe as possible on the road. It's just taking your own personal responsibility, because the more of us that do that, the better chance that we've got of changing the environments on our roads. We could all, you know, we could love people to campaign or join Road Peace, but let's be honest here, what have people got time to do? Dash cams, amazing, or, you know, helmet cams, anything like that, where you can actually report people. So, for example, in this case where the defendant, he wasn't just doing this as a one-off, he's clearly done it repeatedly. If that had been caught on camera and sent into the local police beforehand, could have been prevented, maybe. So there's that, and then just your own personal responsibility. Just think. It's certainly changed my way of driving. Mm. Educate children, talk to your kids, talk to your grandkids about road safety. Mm. I think that's all personally we can ask people to do, just be a bit more aware.
And if our audience, which I'm just thinking of our audience, I'm thinking of the emails we get from our audience, and it's quite surprising, you know, we have MPs listening, we have campaigners, we have local politicians, people who work at councils and things like that. I'm just thinking of the kind of, for want of a better phrase, the lowest hanging fruit of things that could be changed. So one thing that Road Peace told me was that, you know, we could lobby local police to try and encourage bail conditions to include an interim driving ban, for example, which I don't think is done as a matter of course, but is able to be done, for example. Are there any kind of things that feel like with a bit of push that we could, you know, help change the system?
I think speaking on behalf of Calvin, if I may, we've spoken at length about the sentencing for the criminal side of things, which is such a huge thing. But actually on the civil side of things, how bereaved unmarried fathers is treated is absolutely disgusting. A Tory MP, I think, said earlier this year, it was revisited in March or April of this year. And basically the summary was, if you're not married to the mother, the quality of your love to your child will not be the same as if you were a married father. And in 2022, we are now at the stage where unmarried parents are over 50%. So we're completely...
Yeah, we're living in the dark ages.
We're living in the dark ages. So it's actually called the Fatal Accidents Act. Again, the word accident's in there. There's that terminology, and there is the need to change things like reference to illegitimate children, Embury. And that's something that actually, with a little bit of campaigning, if you've got people there that would like to hear more about it, please, you know, we'd love to have that support to change something, because that would make a massive amount of difference to bereaved fathers who are just not considered to be worthy of any recognition for their loss. It's awful.
Wow. And there was a Road Justice report, of course, by the All Party Parliamentary Group for Walking and Cycling, and they had 10 recommendations about ways to improve the justice system. And yeah, ending exceptional hardship was one of them.
Yeah.
Improving understanding of the highway code, the educational piece.
Yeah.
And there are a number of other things in there about ensuring that victims of road collisions were seen as real victims of crime.
Absolutely.
Well, which is,
links into
which is,
the support that they get.
Yeah.
Although something tells me that the level of support you get for any form of crime is probably not where it needs to be either.
No.
Well, thank you very much. I think we'll leave
thanks
you there.
For
I mean,
me.
Thanks an awful lot for coming down, Polly. I gather you're coming down to the West End, aren't you?
Yes.
Next weekend.
Grease Lightning.
Yeah, can't see Grease, which would probably be a slightly easier time than you've had on this podcast. It's been a really interesting discussion. It's been quite bleak at times, but also it's great to feel your sort of positivity and the support you're obviously giving Calvin. And I think from all of us, pass on our best to Calvin and his family because.
Yeah, the strength that he has campaigning,
he's amazing.
In this
they all are, actually.
Environment, and yeah, if the more that people can do to support him and others,
yeah,
about getting, I know it sounds, you know, like obvious and basic, but the more people talking about this, like you said, is going to hopefully make that difference.
And Road Peace do amazing work in this area, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. And Calvin, I'm sure he's going to be creating his own foundation in terms of, in the name of Frankie and Neve, which will very much be focused on road safety education. So I'm sure he'd love to kind of link in with you guys in the future.
All right, splendid. Thank you, Polly. And next time we record, maybe we'll do jaywalking. Maybe you're going to have a 6-part special on jaywalking. You've been listening to Streets Ahead. Our editor has been Claire Mansell. Let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead. Rate us, review us, and share the podcast with anyone you think might enjoy it. Bye-bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.